calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
My friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Seattle, Washington today. Last night, we had it was great. The Iraq War and its toll on working families, put on by AM 1090, Seattle's Progressive Talk, which is where I'm broadcasting from live. And also by the ILWU, the Longshoremen's Union, basically, and America in Solidarity, americasolidarity.com, the website. And it was a fascinating presentation. Congressman Jay Inslee was there. Congressman Jim McDermott was there. I remember the last time I was in Seattle was a couple of years ago, and it was just before George W. Bush decided to declare war. It was just leading up to that election. It must have been just before November, like October of 2002. And the Republicans were milking this for all it was worth. And my good friend who lives in Seattle here, Paul Loeb, and I went down and stood in line at this church for like 3 hours to get in to hear Scott Ritter and Jim McDermott speak. And Jim McDermott gave this impassioned speech about, you know, don't do this, George. And it was just great seeing him last night and speaking with him. He's a fine man. And several of the Rachel Maddow was here, and it was great meeting Rachel. It was what a great person, hanging out, spending some time with her. Zeke Green, he's a longshoreman, this guy, but he does. He referred to as spoken word artist. I'd say just, you know, brilliant public speaking, and just a great presentation that he did, and it was just all around. It was a fine thing. And what was so cool about this was this is 100% volunteer organization that just started 2 years ago. It was founded in 2003. American Solidarity, nonprofit, nonpartisan. They just basically some folks who got together and said, we've got to do something. We've got to do something. And they did. And they did. And they did it brilliantly. And I have some questions here that are left over from the, you know, folks filled out questions during the time of the talks. And I'm going to be getting to some of those as we go along with the day. And your calls, our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 440-THOM. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, it's tomhartman.com, and click on live chat. However you spell Tom Hartman will get you there, although it's correctly spelled T-H-O-M Hartman with two N's. And then just click the live chat button. And my apologies to the folks in the chat room. I can't get in there today. The computer that I'm using right here, the system that I'm using in the studio Talk 1090, has a very high-quality firewall. And their security systems are not allowing chat to get through. So I can't drop in and say hi. But greetings to the folks in the chat room. And tomorrow when I'm back in Portland, Oregon, we'll be saying hi to you. But anyhow, it's a special day today, you know, and it's Columbus Day. And maybe there's things you knew about it. Maybe there's things you didn't. Maybe there's things that you didn't even know that you didn't know. I mean, you know, it's one of those kind of everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be, as Christopher Columbus wrote in a 1503 letter to the King and Queen of Spain, gold is most excellent. Gold constitutes treasure. And he who has it does all he wants in the world and can even lift souls up to paradise. Or as George Herbert Walker Bush said in 1989, Christopher Columbus not only opened the door to a new world, but also set an example for us all by showing what monumental feats can be accomplished through perseverance and faith. Yeah. If you fly over the country of Haiti, on the island of Hispaniola, the island on which Columbus landed, it looks like somebody took a blowtorch and burned away everything green. Even the ocean around the port capital, Port-au-Prince, is choked for miles with the brown of human sewage and eroded topsoil. I remember the first time I flew into Port-au-Prince, it looked like lava flow coming out into the ocean. In a way, the history of this little island is sort of the history of what's going on all over the world, or certainly has been for the last few hundred years. Columbus, of course, not the first European to land in North America. That was over 1,000 years ago. Leif Erikson, at least, the Norwegians were here. But nonetheless, Columbus landed in Hispaniola in 1492. And you know, the map maker who made the original maps, the map maker signed the map when he was all finished. This was in the 1500s. Amerigo Vespucci. And everybody thought that that was like the name of the country. And they just picked up the first word. Otherwise, we'd all be singing, God bless Vespucci land. I mean, a certain amount of sense to it. Anyhow, Columbus first landed on Hispaniola in 1492. Virtually the entire island was covered by lush forest. The Tiano Indians, in quotes, who lived there had apparently an idyllic life from the reports left to us by literate members of Columbus's crew, like Miguel Queno. But in addition to that, I mean, there were Columbus's words as well. He said, this is from his log, he said, they brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears and many other things, which they exchanged for the glass beads and hawk spells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They do not bear arms and do not know them. For I showed them a sword. They took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance. Now, what does this cause Columbus to immediately think of? He's finding people who live in peace, people who have an idyllic, paradisical life. Does he think maybe we can learn something from them? Maybe they have something to teach us. Maybe there's something from their culture, some lesson we... No, he says, they would make fine slaves. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. This is, again, from Columbus's log. As soon as I arrived in the Indies on the first island which I found, I took some of the natives by force in order that they might learn and give me information of whatever there is in these parts. Queno, who was Columbus's number two guy in his crew when he arrived, he notes in his diary, this is from their second visit to Hispaniola. He says, we took captive 2,000 local villagers who had come out to greet us. When our caravels, that's the ship, the flotilla, were to leave for Spain, we gathered 1,600 male and female persons of those Indians, and these we embarked in our caravels on February 17, 1495. For those Spaniards who remained, we let it be known that anyone who wanted to take some of them, some of the Caribs, the native Indians, could do so to the amount desired, which was done. Queno further notes that he himself took a beautiful teenage Carib girl as his personal slave, a gift from Columbus himself, and that when he attempted to have sex with her, she, quote, resisted with all her strength. So in his own words, from his own diary, quote, he, quote, mercilessly thrashed her and raped her, end quote. While Columbus once referred to the Taino Indians as cannibals, a story apparently made up by him, which is still taught in some schools in America today, to help justify his slaughter and enslavement of these people, he wrote to the Spanish monarchs in 1493, quote, it is possible with the name of the Holy Trinity to sell all the slaves which it's possible to sell. Here there are so many of these slaves, and also Brazil wood, that although they are living things, they are as good as gold. Columbus and his men also used the Taino as sex slaves. It was a common reward for Columbus's men to present them with local women to rape. As he began exporting Taino as slaves to other parts of the world, the sex slave trade became an important part of the business. This is not unlike the sex slave trade over in the Mariana Islands that Tom DeLay went over to visit with his good friend Jack Abramoff, saying, oh, isn't it wonderful? Isn't everybody happy? Well, Columbus, as he wrote to a friend in 1500, quoting from Columbus's personal letter, Christopher Columbus, 100 castellanos, a Spanish coin, it would be, you know, $100 or whatever, 100 castellanos are as easily obtained for a woman as for a farm, and it is very general, and there are plenty of dealers who go about looking for girls. Those from 9 to 10 years old are the most in demand, end quote. That from Christopher Columbus. However, the Taino didn't make particularly good slaves. In many cases, Well, as Pedro de Cordoba wrote to King Ferdinand in 1517, quote, as a result of the sufferings and hard labor they endured, the Indians chose and have chosen suicide. Occasionally, 100 have committed mass suicide. The women, exhausted by labor, have shunned conception and childbirth. Many, when pregnant, have taken something to abort and have aborted. Others, after delivery, have killed their children with their own hands so as not to leave them in such oppressive slavery. End quote. By 1496, the population of the Taino had been cut in half. By 1516, the population was down to 12,000, according to Las Casas, who was there. And by 1542, only 200 were still alive. By 1555, every single one was dead. So it's Columbus Day. And, you know, let's take the bigger picture of what can we learn from this. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Not only do we want to change the world, we are changing. You know, stasis almost never happens. Things never stay the same. Things are always moving in one direction or another. And so many people now are getting active. So many people are saying, let's reclaim the traditional values of America. And Christopher Columbus, frankly, did not reflect the traditional values of America. Christopher Columbus reflected the values of empire, of slavery. And yes, I know we had slavery here early on in the United States, and we still have the remnants of it, both in the apartheid in our system here that we're trying to resolve with affirmative action programs and things, trying to undo some of the damage caused by several hundred years of slavery and apartheid in the United States, and also in the exporting of our slavery. You know, I look at the sweater I'm wearing, which was made in some Southeastern Asian, I believe it was made in Malaysia. What can you find? I mean, our slaves. They're somewhere else. But in any case, the real values of America, the ideals on which this country was founded, even if in whole part the founders didn't live up to the ideals that they espoused, at least they put it out there. And to a large extent, I mean, this was an incredibly radical thing to do, to say, what? We don't want any kings. We don't want any theocrats. We don't want any, you know, rich folks running the country, also known as feudalism. We're going to reject all three of the historic forms, 7,000 years of civilization. We're going to reject all three of the historic forms of governance that governed people. And we're going to try something new, something that was only tried for a little short period of time in Athens, Greece, back 3,000 years ago. We're going to try this thing called democracy. We're going to create a republic that is a representative democracy. And those ideals are powerful. Those ideals are extraordinary. One of the questions from last night. This is my chance to ask you one question, so naturally I'm going to ask you two. Question one, everyone is upset that the White House press corps doesn't ask the president the tough questions. If you had the chance to ask one question to Mr. Bush, what would you demand an answer to? Well, I kind of like Cindy Sheehan's question of Mr. Bush, what was the noble cause for which her son died? At the hands, by the way, of the Sadr army, of Sadr's forces. Sadr is, you know, now part of the government that we're propping up there. Although, you know, frankly, personally, the question that I would ask George Bush, I think, if I had an opportunity to actually have a human-to-human conversation with him, is why did you run for president, and what is your vision for this country? Because it seems that everything he is doing, it goes beyond just seems, everything he is doing is to enhance the power of inherited wealth and corporations, corporate power and inherited wealth. And what I'd like to know is, George, are you doing that because that's what you see as the means to an end? That is that, you know, this is what you've got to do to get Republicans in power, to get money for the political process so that you guys can get elected, so that you can hold power because you really think you'll do a better job of governing this country? Or does this actually reflect the end? That is to say, do you really want a nation, when all is said and done, where the only people who have a say in how the country is run, the only people who have a stake in this nation, are people like the Walton family with inherited wealth and people who have very, very high incomes. And that the vast majority of the American citizens are sort of like, you know, braceros, you know, like the Mexican, the illegal immigrants from Mexico here right now that you want to give a temporary status to as long as they have an employer who will vouch for them. So they're basically slaves of that employer. If he or she speaks ill of them, boom, they're gone. I mean, is that your idea? Do you really want to take us, George, back to the world of France under Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, or of England during the era of Queen Victoria, that Charles Dickens so elegantly wrote about in A Christmas Carol? You know.
Mr. Scrooge, may I have, please, a lump of coal?
No, you can't, Mr. Cratchit. Ah, get back to work.
But my hands are so cold, I can hardly write with this pen.
I don't care. It'll cost an extra penny.
Is that the world that George Bush wants to take us back to? It may be. It may be. I mean, there is truth to the statement that conservatives have been making, to the argument that conservatives in the United States of America have been making since 1954, when Russell Kirk wrote The Conservative Mind, the book that animated Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley, when they suggested that you can't trust in their mind. You can't trust a real democracy. You can't really trust the rabble, because they'll simply vote themselves all kinds of money from the public wealth, and they'll tax the rich people, and eventually the system will collapse. I mean, that really is their worldview. They think if you really give the people power, the people will vote themselves all the money, and they'll just sit around and put themselves on perpetual welfare. It's not true. Every example in history shows that it's not true. You look at the countries that have good, solid social safety nets, and they have less unemployment than we have and fewer people on welfare than we have. It's not true, but they believe it's true. And they've established this mythology, and so many people in America have bought into it because they simply don't know how it works in other countries. They don't know what's going on all around the world. So anyway, to answer that question, that would be, I guess, my question to you. Also, question two, is there any hope the Democrats will take back the House in 2006 or the White House in 2008? Yes, I think big time. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I know a place. Ain't nobody crying.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Ain't no smiling faces. No, lying to the races.
Can we make our electoral races clean? Is it possible that we can create clean elections in the United States? There's two states that have already done it to some extent, and a good start on them, Arizona and Maine. In fact, publiccampaign.org has some interesting interviews. This is Chris Rector, the Republican from Maine, talking about the wonders of electoral reform.
The advantages of running as a clean elections candidate for me are truly that I have much more time to spend with my constituents, and I don't have to worry about attending fundraising events, creating fundraising events, having that be my focus. I can really talk about issues and spend my time going door to door, meeting with constituents and understanding what the issues are that concern them.
Randella. Boy, it's hard to read it. Newhouse, an activist in Arizona.
To me, justice, because clean elections gives people an opportunity to run for office. Any minority or minority group people at different economic levels, it just would be, it's a fairer system, I think.
Here's Nancy Smith, Democrat from Maine.
There's a lot of freedom that comes with that. I really can focus on what my constituents need and not worry about if I'm upsetting anybody and if it's going to cost me in the next election. I can really focus on what I think good policy is.
Well, the things that made me decide to run as a clean elections candidate.
This is Leah Taylor, Democrat from Arizona.
First of all, it was a new opportunity. When I first ran as a clean election candidate, I was already an incumbent. And so I had the option to go the traditional way, which probably would have been the easiest direction to go in. But I wanted to do something for the community to see, would this really work? Would it engage the community? Would it really involve our constituents to feel like they had a stake here?
And apparently it really did work. And others are looking in other states all around the United States. People are looking at how to bring about electoral reform. And, you know, this is like one of the great issues of our day, one of the great questions of our day, one of the big great issues of our day. And Steve Chesson, and in fact, you know, one of the questions that was brought up last night at this Iraq war and its toll on working families that was put on by Seattle's Progressive Talk AM 1090, ILWU, and AmericaSolidarity.com, was it seems critical that the left Democrats must make some gains in the 2006 elections to ensure any hope of getting Bush out of office. What can we do to eliminate voting fraud, corruption, and have fair elections? Jeff Paulson and Kenmore Washington tossed that question in. And so Steve Chesson is the president of Californians for Electoral Reform. The website is cfer.org. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Very pleased to have you with us. Tell us what's being done in California in this regard.
Well, what we're doing in California is what our organization is working on is instant runoff voting and proportional representation. I mean, clean elections is good. It encourages more people to run. But if you still elect somebody with just a plurality of the votes, whoever gets the most votes wins, you might get somebody elected. If you got five candidates running, you might get somebody elected with as little as 23% of the vote.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of us think that that's not very good for democracy.
So there's two fundamental problems in the American democratic process. The first is that along with Greece, Australia, and New Zealand, we're basically one of the few out of over 100 democracies in the world, one of the few that actually has first-past-the-post winner-take-all elections, where if you have more than two parties, then a third party can cause somebody to win with a minority, and a fourth or fifth party will guarantee that whoever wins actually doesn't represent the majority of the people.
As a matter of fact, there's a well-known political science principle called Duverger's Law that basically says when you do have first-past-the-post plurality elections, that basically prevents the growth of third parties.
Right. Well, of course. And we've never seen a successful third-party movement in the United States over a long period of time other than the ones that grew out of the death of a second party. For example, when the Federalists imploded in the early 1800s, the Whigs emerged. And when the Whigs imploded in the 1840s, the Republicans emerged in the 1850s. But basically since then, whether it was Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose or John Anderson's attempt or Ross Perot's attempt, or Ralph Nader's attempt, for that matter, every time a third party comes along, it harms the one of the two major political parties that's closest to it and throws the election in the direction that's the actual opposite of what the majority of Americans want.
That's exactly right, and instant runoff voting can eliminate that spoiler effect.
Right, which is why they did that in New Zealand and Australia. They've instituted there a version of instant runoff voting across those two nations. So I know the Green Party is very active on this across the United States, and I encourage people to get involved with the Green Party, particularly at the local levels. And that doesn't mean that you can't also be involved with the Democratic or Republican Party as well. It is possible to, you know, you can do all of the above. And are you with the Green Party, or is this just specific electoral issues?
Actually, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm also very active with the California Democratic Party. As a matter of fact,
that's great, Steve.
Just last weekend, at the same time that the conference in Portland was going on, the California Democratic Party Executive Board was meeting in Los Angeles, and we passed a resolution supporting instant runoff voting.
That's marvelous. We're talking with Steve Chesson, the president of Californians for Electoral Reform, www.cfer.org, as in Californians for Electoral Reform, CFER. And so, number one, you're working for instant runoff voting across the United States. Is your plan of attack to do it at a local level and then go to state and then go to county and statewide and then take it national? Or are you going to try right for the national and try and get, what would it be, a law or a constitutional amendment? How do you do it?
Well, you don't need a constitutional amendment to have instant runoff voting nationwide, but our approach is to start at the local level for a variety of reasons. One reason is you're a lot more likely to get success at the local level because you've got a much smaller universe that you have to convince that this is a good idea. Secondly, elected officials are used to what got them elected. And so they're very wary of changing the rules by which they get elected. And we notice that people who run for Congress usually have served in state assemblies or state legislatures first, and people who serve in state legislatures have usually served on city councils or county boards of supervisors first.
Right.
So if we change the rules at the local level and get politicians used to being elected within
sure.
the run of voting.
Yeah, then the incubator, the place where people learn politics, that will be what's natural to them, and they'll want to carry it along with them.
Right.
And it makes perfect sense. Now, you also mentioned proportional representation. I think most Americans don't know what proportional representation means. This is a form of government that was basically put forward in a big way in the 1860s by John Stuart Mill, although it had been floating around for a while before that, but he popularized it. And most of the countries in the world have proportional representation. Give us a 30-second crash course, Steve Chesson, in what that means.
Okay, basically, the basic principle of proportional representation is majority rule with representation for the electoral minority in direct proportion to the way people vote. So, for example, if you're part of a group that represents 60% of the electorate, you'll get 60% of the seats in the legislature, not all of them. And if you're part of the electorate that only represents 10% of the folks, then you'll get 10% of the seats, not nothing.
So, in other words, when Ross Perot, for example, when his Reform Party took, didn't they take something like 17, 18% of the vote in that election?
I think he got 19% in his first election.
Yeah, 19%. This was in the one with Bush and Clinton. And had that been proportional representation, it's an imperfect analogy because we were simply voting for President of the United States. But had we been voting for in a parliamentary system where you're voting for members of a parliamentary body, whether it would be called the House of Representatives or be called Parliament or whatever, had a party gotten 19% of the vote, they would have 19% of the seats.
That's correct, although I do want to correct you on one thing.
Sure.
It's important not to confuse a parliamentary system with proportional representation.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, parliamentary system. England has a parliamentary system, but they elect from single-member districts using first-past-the-post. Parliamentary system just means that the ruling party or ruling coalition in the legislature gets to establish the government. They get to elect the cabinet.
Right.
We have a presidential system where whoever's president gets to determine the government. They get to choose the cabinet.
So then you suggest that the British system is not proportional representation.
That is correct. It's a parliamentary system, but not proportional. But, you know, I mean, the two things are orthogonal. You can have parliamentary systems that are winner-take-all. You can have parliamentary systems that are proportional. You can have presidential systems that are proportional.
Isn't Canada a little bit of each?
I'm sorry?
Isn't Canada a little bit of each?
Okay, Canada. Canada still has a first-past-the-post system. There's talk of proportional. In there, province of British Columbia just held a referendum, a national referendum on changing their provincial government, the electoral system there from first past the post to a proportional system. And it got an overwhelming majority of the vote, but the rules were set up that it needed to get 60% of the vote.
Yeah.
And
so do you think that we should either go with IRV or go with proportional representation, or can we do both? And how do we go about this? And I mean, this seems like, frankly, proportional representation would be a much larger educational process for Americans than even IRV. We have about a minute left, Steve.
Okay. Well, IRV is good for single winner elections, like when you're electing a mayor. Proportional representation is good when you're electing a city council. The kind of system you can use for proportional representation for city councils is where you rank the candidates, same kind that you use for instant runoff voting where you rank the candidates. We feel that instant runoff voting will educate people on how to rank candidates so that it will make it easy to switch them to the choice voting form of proportional representation.
Ah, it makes perfect sense. So you just push both of them at the same time.
Yeah.
Steve Chesson, he's the president of Californians for Electoral Reform, CFER.org. Other missions like this around the country, Steve?
Well, actually, in your home state of Oregon, there's a group in Ashland that's working for instant runoff voting.
Great. We got to wrap it up. Steve, thanks so much for being with us. Steve Chesson, CFER.org. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So, hey, there's a new... American way. No one serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say, don't mess with the U.S. of A.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. See, that's what we were talking earlier about George W. Bush's worldview.
Did you watch the Sunshine State? How the scales got tipped to seal Al's fate? Jeb Bush winked, I told you so.
Yeah. I mean, you know, is it all about crony capitalism? Is it all about, you know, power for power's sake? Is that the kind of world that George W. Bush wants us to live in? Sometimes it seems like it. By the way, we've had a caller who I haven't gotten to. I'm sorry, and dropped off the line from Grand Rapids. Somebody listening on WTKG who was asked, what's the significance of the Schroeder Merkel thing going on in Germany? And this is fascinating. The election in Germany, Gerhard Schroeder has and Angela Merkel have just reached an agreement where Merkel is going to become the prime minister, essentially. She's going to lead the government. And she's the head of the Christian Democratic Union, which is sort of like the Republicans there. And Gerhard Schroeder is going to be the, he's not really going to be the number two guy. But his Social Democratic Party is going to maintain a number of the politically powerful centers within the government. And it's interesting. Merkel is the first female chancellor for Germany. She came from East Germany. She's an academic physicist. She's the daughter of a pastor. The Social Democrats get control of eight of 14 ministries in the new government, including key ministries such as finance, foreign affairs, labor, and justice. So what you're seeing really playing out in Germany right now is the rise of the conservatives. And we've been seeing the same thing in France for some time. You've been seeing it in England ever since Margaret Thatcher. Even the Labor Party, Tony Blair's Labor, it's a new Labor. It's just like here in the United States. This has all been going on basically since right around 1980, when Reagan and Thatcher led the charge of let's swing government back toward the right. Let's swing government in the direction of multinational control, inherited wealth. That's where the real power is. That's how you can establish a power base if you're a politician. That's how you can make sure that you get elected over and over and over again. That's how you can make sure that you don't have to worry. You can crush your political enemies. And perhaps most important, that's the way the multinational corporations want it. You've got people on the far right who for years, and to this day, I mean, folks in the Republican Party, hysterical about the United Nations because they say, oh, the UN, they're going to take away our sovereignty. Name one law in the United States that the United Nations has said, sorry, you can't do that. About the only thing anybody can come up with these days is torture. You know, the Geneva Conventions against torture. You know, well, the United Nations says you can't torture people. That's just, John McCain agrees. It doesn't make sense to be torturing people. It's a lousy, lousy way to get information in the first place. It hurts you more than it helps you. Plus, it puts your own soldiers at risk. So that's about it. But if you look at the organizations that are made up of and largely controlled by multinational corporations, where multinational corporations get to sit in the seats of power right alongside nation states, NAFTA, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA Chapter 11, in those hearings that are held, when a country is sued by a corporation, the people, the three-judge tribunals who sit on it in secret, are very often made up of corporate representatives. Corporations have equal power. And they have actually rolled back laws in the United States. They've changed our laws on how funeral homes are handled. They've changed our laws on the types of additives we can have in our gasoline. Laws passed by representatives of we the people. They changed our law about dolphin-safe tuna. After 25 years of the Humane Society of the United States working to get that law passed, they got it rolled back. So you want to see the real loss of sovereignty in the United States, the thing that anybody who's really concerned about America first and all that, you know, the nice talk that the Republicans talk, but it's not the walk they're walking. It should be, and rightly is, this a serious, legitimate, very real concern about multinational corporate control. And that is the group, the multinational corporations, who are behind the rise of the right, the conservatives. This has become what conservative means. They put a social patina on it. They talk about things like abortion and, you know, waving the flag and obscenity in public and like that. That's to bring along the average Joe. But really what it's about, it's about money and power. And it's about money and power for a small elite and for changing the rules of the game of business, for changing the laws so that power can concentrate in fewer and fewer hands in greater ways. And that's what you're seeing happen in Germany right now. It's what you've been seeing happen in England. And people wonder why, you know, Europe is sliding into recessions. And people are terrified. They've, you know, for the last 15 years or so, well, particularly since reunification in Germany, it was a huge hit that the country took. But the big problem that many of the old European nations are facing is that because of the European Union, you've got, you know, all this cheap labor now available in the new European nations, the former Soviet bloc nations, and it's driving down the standard of living all across Europe, and people are freaked out. They don't know what to do, and so they say, well, let's change something, and so they grab the conservatives and say, help us, not knowing that the conservatives are like the ones behind all this, saying, hey, this is great for us. This is great for the big corporations. So that's my take on what's happening. I think it's a dangerous direction for Central Europe to be going. And you'll notice that the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Danes are not going in that direction at all. And they're saying, hey, thank you very much. We like having a nice standard of living. We like everybody having a free education, including college. We like everybody having free health care. We like the fact that, yes, you can build a business in this country, in Norway and Sweden and Denmark. You can build it, and the other Scandinavian nations, you can build a business, you can get rich, but not incredibly rich. That we view as a social sickness. You can become a millionaire, you can become a multimillionaire, but billionaires, you know, there's a limit, really, of how much you can suck out of the public. There just seems like a rational limit. And in the United States, that was common sense up until 1980, and Reagan came along and all these right-wing think tanks, and they started changing the whole paradigm, and they've done so startlingly successfully. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to Your Light at the End of the Tunnel of Talk Radio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you today by MotorSilk. 1-866-LESS-FUEL. LESSFUEL. For more information, give them a call and say hi. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Harriet Meyer's nomination, an interesting one. It's in the news again. It seems that our Jethro moment. Yes, our Jethro moment continues. George W.
She is plenty bright.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you, Jethro. We needed to know that. We just wanted to know for sure. You know, is she plenty bright? Well, it turns out. And then Brit Hume over the weekend, he's like, well, you know, she's pretty bright for somebody who's not a white male. And he kind of revealing the bias of faux news. All right, here's Brit Hume on Fox News Sunday basically saying, well, you know, if Bush had not said that he was not going to consider white males, then... Or his saying that he wasn't going to consider white males, that was the big problem. Because there's plenty of qualified white males out there. But when you got to start looking at women and minorities, then, you know, it gets kind of difficult because, you know, they're just not as smart and not as good as it. Now, essentially, I mean, that's the subtext of this whole thing. I'll let Brit Hume tell you himself.
To the extent that the president flinched, he flinched on this point. And that is, he decided it had to had to be a woman and or a minority. And that narrowed the field. And I think it's also the case that while, you know, he had just named to the appellate bench some quite likely-seeming candidates, Priscilla Owen being one, Janice Rogers Brown another, and after prolonged battles lasting years, gotten them confirmed. I think that he was still operating from a much narrower list. And in that context, she looked much better than she would have against a full field, men and women alike.
Yeah, in other words, if there had been white guys in there, we would have found a one we want. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Britt. Appreciate that. Now, interestingly, from thinkprogress.org, last week, right-wing focus on the family head, James Dobson. He put his foot in his mouth, and he's got a lot of conservatives going, "Say what?" Focus on the family head, James Dobson, said that his support for Harriet Myers was in part due to confidential information he had received during a phone conversation with Karl Rove. On CBS's Face the Nation, Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democrat from New York, said to Rove and Dobson, "Hey, how about telling us this? We're on the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're the ones who are supposed to decide if this woman is actually qualified to be on the Supreme Court. Yes, we understand she is plenty smart, but is it plenty smart or plenty bright or what was that anyway? It was that.
She is plenty bright.
Plenty bright. Thank you. There you go. Yeah. So we got that, but we really would like to know. You know, is there something else going on here? I mean, what's the deal? So Senator Schumer. This on CBS's Face the Nation. He says, "This is no way to nominate a Supreme Court justice. For that nominee to refuse to answer questions of the American public and then have someone supporting her, do all this whispering saying, 'She's okay, here's what she believes.' This is unfair," he says. "So as a result, I believe we ought to call on James Dobson," he says. Let's call James Dobson before the United States Senate as a witness at the Senate Judiciary hearing and find out what kind of assurances he has received. If those assurances are good enough for James Dobson, then all of America ought to hear them. I believe my Democratic colleagues will go along, and we will have James Dobson as a witness. Additionally, I think Karl Rove ought to let the public know what kind of assurances he gave James Dobson. This is not a game of wink and whisper. This is serious business." Now, Arlen Specter, the Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, the guy who is running the show here, he says, "If there is something which bears upon a precondition as to how the nominee is going to vote, I think it's a matter that ought to be known by the Judiciary Committee and the American people." So Stephanopoulos says, let me clarify this. Are you saying you're actually going to pull Dobson and Karl Rove in front of the Senate Judiciary Specter? "I haven't made up a witness list, but I have done something unprecedented. I've divided the 30 witnesses equally between Democrats and Republicans. Maybe that's a witness Pat Leahy will want to call. In other words, he's going to let the Republicans call witnesses." Specter says, "If Pat Leahy doesn't call him, Arlen Specter may. I want to know the facts. I'm very fact-oriented, and Dr. Dobson knows something that he shouldn't know or something that I ought to know. I'm going to find out." Well, Senator Specter and Senator Schumer, for that matter. Let me just share it with you. I mean, this is Richard Land in an RNC conference call. I'm assuming this is the conference call that they're talking about. If not, it was probably very, very similar content. I played this last Friday, but it's worth repeating. In fact, it probably should, probably should be played every 15 minutes on Progressive Talk Radio all across the United States over and over and over again until finally somebody on the national media picks it up. Although, I have to say, I think, first of all, if it's true, it's a really scary thing to say. So we know how somebody thinks, and we know that they're never going to change their mind, and that they're only going to do what the Bush family tells them to do, henceforth forever, forever, world without end, amen. And that they're not going to change over 20 years. I mean, think of yourself 20 years ago. I mean, George W. Bush has changed in 20 years. He quit drinking, quit doing cocaine, quit, you know. So, anyhow, here's this Richard Land RNC conference call.
"And this president, and he knows that Harriet Myers is also a Texan, and with a degree of understanding that would never have to be articulated."
No, they don't have to say it out loud. You know, Bush doesn't have to say to Myers, "You got to vote the way I'm telling you to vote." It never has to be said out loud because she knows her place.
"He and she both understand that if she were to get on the court and she were to rule in ways that are contrary to the way the president would want her to approach her role as a justice, it would be a deep personal betrayal and would be perceived as such both by him and by her.
In other words, she is not willing to betray George W. Bush. She is his sock puppet. She is going to do whatever he says. Don't you worry, says Richard Land. And these are the assurances that James Dobson is getting.
And he knows in nominating a woman who comes from outside the Beltway bubble, whose culture was formed in Texas, and who doesn't care what the New York Times thinks. She doesn't care. And he doesn't care, which is one reason why they've been successful conservatives. I think this is a brilliant nomination, and I think it'll be confirmed in the way she rules on cases that are very important to us over the next decade.
To us being the Reich, don't worry. We're putting a puppet on the Supreme Court. I mean, that's what it's all about. We're putting a puppet on the Supreme Court. Is that the court you want? Is that the way you want it to work? Is that how, you know, a lot of people have problems with that. Other people are thinking, hey, maybe she'll be a David Souter. Maybe she'll become her own person. Maybe Lyndon Johnson was right that you nominate somebody to the Supreme Court and they become your enemy. Maybe. There's a lot of Democrats really having a hard time with this, and legitimately so, I think. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-TOM. Jim in San Francisco, California on the line. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, hi. Really enjoyed the conversation about instant runoff voting. We in San Francisco here have been using it for quite a while.
Well, it's been about 2 years, isn't it?
Yeah, actually it passed about 3 years ago, but it took a while for them to implement it.
Uh-huh.
And it worked very well. People like it a lot, but you know, I think we have to start thinking at a higher level. I think we have to start thinking of those states which are most likely to pass instant runoff voting. And so I've been looking at states that are swing states in which the Democrats can really get severely punished by an independent candidacy.
Right.
And I've been looking at states in which the Democrats have the governorship and the legislature.
Yeah.
Where they have no excuse, really.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, traditionally, both the Republicans and the Democrats have opposed instant runoff voting. And the reason why is because it brings other parties into the process in a way that they can actually have some say without killing off the major parties. And the only time that the major parties ever agree with instant runoff voting is when it's always just one party. And it's the party that's on the strong side. And they could be threatened by a third party coming in. So good logic to that, Jim.
Exactly.
And good logic to it.
Tom?
Yeah, real quick.
Tom, I wanted to mention that Howard Dean right now supports it.
I know. Howard Dean, in fact, he's been talking about this since he was governor of Vermont, you know, the state where I used to live. So Howard Dean's a good man. Instant runoff voting. Will it save America? I think it's possible. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. Shake it up.
Shake it up, my friends. Time to shake up the political process. Get out there, get active. Show up at some of those party meetings. Show up at a meeting. Join democracyforamerica.com, for example. There's just americasolidarity.com. A lot of great groups out there. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-TOM, 1-866-440-THOM, and Larry in Seattle, Washington, the city where I am currently broadcasting live from Seattle's Progressive Talk AM 1090. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I just wanted to point out something that might be a little bit counter to the Bush legal philosophy in Harriet Myers. When she successfully argued back in the 2000 election that Dick Cheney is definitely not a Texan. She argued that the 12th Amendment did not allow Dick Cheney to run as vice president because he was from the same state as is George Bush, Texas.
Yeah, although he's actually from Wyoming. I think what you're talking about is, wasn't Dick Cheney at the time, along with a whole lot of other folks, claiming Texas as a legal resident simply because he didn't have to pay income tax there?
Exactly right. He owned a residence there, and he spent all his time there. He only spent his time in Wyoming back during the time when he was part of that delegation.
Well, George Herbert Walker Bush, I mean, started this thing way, way back when. In fact, Doonesbury, I remember during Bush's presidency, Doonesbury had this thing of, you too can become a resident of Texas and no longer pay income tax. And they had a form that you could fill out in the comic strip in the Sunday papers and send it into the Secretary of State in Texas to change your legal residence so that you could vote in Texas and therefore claim for tax purposes that you no longer had to pay taxes in whatever state you lived in. And, you know, that Bush Sr. had been doing this. We learned recently that Karl Rove has been doing this. George W. does this, obviously. And although he at least has an old pig farm there that he bought just in time for the 2000 election, turned it into a dude ranch, sort of. I'm not sure you can call it that because he's afraid of horses. There's no horses there, but or any horses that might be there, he doesn't go near. But whatever you want to call it, 1,600 acres, a lot of land. And Dick Cheney. But anyhow, what's your point about Harriet Myers? I mean,
I was trying to make was that this points out in a very conservative Wall Street Journal on the front page, right in the very middle, that she is not the conservative that George Bush wants to paint her to be.
This is today's Wall Street Journal?
The Friday, October 7th Wall Street Journal.
Oh, last
and,
week.
And she... was running, according to what they say here, the way she did that was striking. Her legal team successfully persuaded a judge to take what her brief described as a broad and inclusive reading of the Constitution, which runs counter to the conservative tradition of legal interpretation that calls for a relatively narrow reading of that constitutional text.
Yeah, and this is one of many reasons why you've got a whole bunch of conservatives who are all totally hysterical and freaked out about this. Larry, thanks for the call and the point. I mean, that's the thing. What the conservatives are terrified of is that Harriet Myers is going to be a David Souter, that she's going to be somebody who, in her heart, is actually a fairly reasonable, rational American who simply has, out of circumstance and self-interest and whatever, aligned herself in with the loyalty, you know, the family loyalty, the friendship loyalty, the political loyalty of the Bush family over the years. And what the Bushies are saying, and what you heard in this conference call with Richard Land, is what they're saying is, don't worry, she'll go with us. We know the way that she's going to vote, because if she voted any other way, that would be viewed as a betrayal by Bush. And she's not willing to betray him because she's a sock puppet. She will just do whatever she's told. And you just don't have to worry. And a lot of conservatives are not buying it. They're saying, wait a minute, you don't understand. You get on the Supreme Court. I mean, that's what Dwight Eisenhower thought about Earl Warren. You know, you get on the Supreme Court, and you can go any direction you please. I mean, that's what Eisenhower thought about Harry Blackmun. And it didn't quite work out that way. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. I'm the other Rick that occasionally calls the show. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Excellent. Tom, were you aware of the bankruptcy filing of Delphi over the weekend? Did you read any about that?
Yeah, and in fact, there have been several very good articles about that. Delphi is one of the big providers of parts to in particular General Motors, but also to Ford and some of the other automakers and Chrysler. And where this is significant is basically what's happening is, you know, most people don't realize GM has already outsourced a lot of the manufacture of their engine blocks to China. And now the auto companies are saying to companies like Delphi, if you're going to provide us with parts, you have to do it at prices that are below what can be done if you manufacture in the United States. It's the race to the bottom. All the pressure is outsource and offshore. And Delphi didn't do it fast enough, didn't do it well enough, and got caught. Or at least that's my take on it.
Well, a thing I wanted to point out, Tom, if I may, there's a website that I think your listeners would be very interested in. It's the Detroit Free Press website, www.freep.com. The reason why I point that out is one of the columnists is named Brian Dickerson, and he's got a terrific column that says, the title is Them That's Got Shall Get.
Yeah.
And it points out that on the eve, the night before the filing of Delphi, where they've asked the workers to take up to a 63% pay cut, the top 21
executives. The top 21 executives just paid themselves hugely.
There you go.
Yeah, they gave themselves multi-million-dollar bonuses and paid themselves. Yeah, absolutely. And that's nothing new, by the way. That, Rick, that is fairly typical. They're looting the pension funds and running and not just Delphi, all over the place. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
We've taken all you give. It's getting hard to make a living. Mr. President, it's pity on working man.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay Republican hooker. Welcome back to our program. Oh, my. The tragedy of Gannongate. That was an investigation worthy of an investigation. And speaking of investigations, and by the way, our telephone number, toll-free, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click on the live chat button. And greetings to the folks in our chat room. Sorry I can't be with you today. I will be tomorrow, though, when I get back to Oregon tonight. But I'm doing the program live here from Seattle's Progressive Talk, AM 1090, where last night, and their computer just doesn't let me in, but last night, America in Solidarity presented the Iraq War and its toll on working families. And we had a great opportunity to hear from Congressmen Jay Inslee and Jim McDermott. Rachel Maddow was there, and it was very, very nice hanging out. Louise and I really enjoyed meeting Rachel and Susan and some great folks. And Zeke Green, a spoken word artist, he's a longshoreman with the ILWU Local 23, did a great job, set the stage for us, got the thing going. Bert Sachs, Rick Bender, Mike Beckett, Mike Kearney, and Todd Iverson, a whole, you know, great crew there. And special thanks to all the folks here at Talk 1090, Seattle's Progressive Talk, AM 1090, for providing us with studio and making everything work. Anyhow, back to the whole question of what's coming down the road for the Republicans. It looks like they're getting ready. They're getting ready. Time Magazine, this piece, Rove Redux, by Viveka Novak and Mike Allen. As top Bush aide Karl Rove prepares for his fourth grand jury appearance, the federal probe into who leaked CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity to the media is believed to be wrapping up. And could it be that Joe Wilson, you know, who was on this program last week, that he's going to get his wish?
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
Karl Rove, ambassador, why would you just toss that? This was over a year ago. Over a year ago. Why would you just throw out that name? I mean, you know, what, he being loose-lipped?
And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
Now, at the same time, the guy who was the last, you know, ambassador to Iraq, the last senior diplomatic official from the United States in Iraq, under Bush Sr., an employee of Bush Sr., at the same time that he was saying, it's Karl Rove, it's Karl Rove. We had George W. Bush reminding us that, well, maybe we'll never know, you know.
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official, now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, we're starting to get an idea. Looks like it's George Bush, looks like it's Karl Rove and Scooter Libby who did the dirty work. Now, you know, there's an old thing about the way the mob works, and that is that the guys who do the dirty work are not always the guys who came up with the idea. And there's a big question out there about whether George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are going to be listed as unindicted co-conspirators in Treasongate, in this treasonous outing of a CIA officer and the entire undercover operation called Brewster Jennings that she was running, named after Mr. Brewster, one of the founders of Aramco, the Arab American oil company, the original oil company in Saudi Arabia. Time Magazine. See, they're preparing their base. This is what this is all about. They are preparing their base. Time Magazine, quoting a Bush advisor, "These guys are bullies and they threaten you." Gee, you want to have bullies talk to Bill Clinton about John Roberts and his boss Ken Starr. White House allies consider life without Karl Rove. This is from the thinkprogress.org blog. Of course, at the same time, after urging Americans to avoid unnecessary travel, George Bush and his gas-guzzling entourage are looking for photo ops today on their eight-day trip to the Gulf Coast, the eighth trip since Katrina struck. But in any case, back to this thing. Bill Kristol, who's the editor of the Weekly Standard, whose father, arguably, along with Joe Coors, who recently deceased, was Richard Mellon Scaife, were the founders. Certainly the intellectual founders. You could possibly toss Bill Buckley into that bunch. I suspect that there are a lot of places where Bill Buckley wants to go off in a different direction from these guys. But in any case, Bill Kristol, Weekly Standard editor on Fox News Sunday, preparing the base, saying, "Get ready." He said, and I quote, "Criminal defense lawyers I've spoken to who are friendly to the administration are very worried that there will be one or more indictments in the next 3 weeks of senior administration officials. Just looking at what Fitzgerald is doing and taking him at his word, you know, being a serious prosecutor here, and I think it's going to be bad for the Bush administration." Now, as Judd points out over on the Think Progress blog, and he's spot on, someone like Bill Kristol information like this just doesn't fall into his lap. This is no accident. Somebody is working with Bill Kristol to say to the Republican base, get ready, it's going to be ugly, it's going to be dirty. You're going to see Karl Rove indicted for treason, essentially, and possibly Scooter Libby. And maybe even Bush and Cheney will be unindicted co-conspirators. You can't indict a sitting president. Only Congress can do that. And it's extremely unlikely that Denny Hastert is going to allow the introduction onto the House of Representatives of a bill of impeachment. But the prosecutor can say, hey, they're guilty as sin, even if he doesn't have the authority to indict them. He's preparing the base. In fact, at the end of the segment, the Fox News segment, Bill Kristol said, and I quote, "I hate the criminalization of politics." Oh, really? Well, you want to stop the criminalization of politics? Get the criminals out of political life! I mean, here you've got Bill Frist, insider trading. You got Tom DeLay, money laundering. You've got, the bribery with the whole Randy Cunningham. It just goes on and on and on. Get the criminals out. I mean, it's really simple to say to the Republicans, enough already. I hate the criminalization of politics. Yeah. I'm telling you, a big one is coming. A big one is coming. New evidence that what I was suggesting, by the way, new evidence, slightly changed the subject here, but maybe not. You'll recall when Tom Ridge retired as director of Homeland Security. Tom Ridge, who was in charge of the terror alerts. When Tom Ridge retired, he went on record. In fact, I watched him on The Daily Show with John Stewart. He went on record saying he didn't ask for all those terror alerts during the presidential campaign. Every time good news came out for John Kerry, every time bad news came out for George W. Bush, all of a sudden there'd be a terror alert. Well, the terror alert's up in New York. The terror alert's up in San Francisco. In Los Angeles, they've just raised the terror alert. Terror alerts are popping up all over the place. And Tom Ridge then came out and said, and it was widely reported, USA Today did a story, others did stories, and saying, Tom Ridge saying, wasn't my idea. It wasn't his idea. Wait a minute, he was the guy who came up with the color codes. It wasn't your idea? No, it wasn't my idea. Then whose idea? Well, it came out of the White House. And who's running it? Well, Karl Rove. It was all about politics. And so last week, on the day that Rove has to go before the grand jury, oh, we don't want anybody knowing about that. All of a sudden, there's a terror alert in New York City. And of course, that wasn't the only bad news. I mean, it was just generally a bad news day for the White House. And you've got, in our concentration camp down at Guantanamo Bay, you've got people on a starving themselves to death, looking like something out of Dachau now, down to 100 pounds. The possible release of more pictures. By the way, you saw this website. Now That's Really Effed Up was the website.com. Where the guy, it was a porno site where the guy was offering to exchange. He said, you know, if you're a soldier and you want to get into the pay-for porno site for free because you're not making much money in Iraq, just post some pictures from Iraq and you can get in. And I don't think he really expected what he was going to get, but he got these gruesome pictures of soldiers posing with murdered Iraqis, basically, is the only way to describe it. Just gruesome pictures. So he put them up on the web. So what happened? Over the weekend, they busted him for pornography. Put the guy out of his... He's in jail on either $135,000 or $153,000 bail. I don't have the story in front of me. I read it in the paper over the weekend. I mean, here he is, this guy. Charlie Wilson was his name, I think. Anyhow, he's in jail for pornography. And it was just a normal porn website. It was basically amateur porn. You could post your, you know, family pornography. It wasn't like child pornography. It wasn't like bestiality. It wasn't S&M. It's just plain old garden variety porn. But they're going to go after him. Why? Well, because he's getting a little publicity, that there are photos there that make the Abu Ghraib photos look tame. This administration, you know, you cross them, they'll take you down. It's like you don't mess with the Gotti family either. You know, you just got to be really, really careful. The Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank for the Republican National Committee. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be.
There you go, my friends. That was last night, the Iraq War and its toll on working families, the topic of the talk, AmericaSolidarity.com. The folks who put the thing on, it was great. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from Seattle, Washington, AM 1090, Seattle's Progressive Talk, hosting our show today. And thanks to them, pleasure being here with you. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. And that story I was telling you about, this here's the Miami Herald. It got a lot of publicity a week or so ago when it was revealed that this website was up. But very little publicity when the guy got busted. I was frankly amazed it wasn't a major story, that it, you know, the news media didn't cover it. Here, Orlando. This is an article by Travis Reed in the Associated Press. A Lakeland man, Lakeland, Florida. Jeb Bush's goons took this guy out. A Lakeland man who runs a pornographic website was arrested on sexual obscenity charges, but his lawyer said the charges are related to grisly photos from Iraq. That's the subhead. And here's the story by Travis Reed, the AP, as published in the Miami Herald. Dateline Orlando, a man who runs a pornographic website that includes pictures of Iraqi war dead has been arrested on sexual obscenity charges. Chris Wilson, a 27-year-old former policeman from Lakeland, was taken into custody Friday night on one felony and 300 misdemeanor indecency counts unrelated to the grisly pictures from Iraq. The charges come a week after his site made national news and launched a Pentagon investigation into how war zone photos of bodies described as victims of U.S. attacks could have surfaced. Polk County Sheriff's Officer said he was charged because the website also features sexually explicit photos and videos that users sent of women who are supposedly their wives and girlfriends. Sheriff officials insist the charges are unrelated to the Iraq pictures, but Wilson's lawyer, Clarence Walters, disagrees. Says Walters, a First Amendment specialist, quote, of all the hundreds of thousands of webmasters in the country, and even in Central Florida, why would Chris Wilson be arrested a week after he hits national spotlight news on the Iraqi war photos? I think any reasonable person would be suspicious of that. Wilson remained in jail Saturday afternoon after the judge in his initial appearance denied his request to lower the $151,000 bail. In a recent interview with the Herald, Wilson defended his website. What people don't understand, he says, is that there's a big difference between what's illegal and what people don't like. Wilson said he started giving soldiers free access after some reported problems paying the $10 membership fee. To make sure he wasn't scammed, Wilson said, he asked for a photograph proving that they were serving in Iraq. He allowed those photos to be posted on his site, calling it a real look at what's going on over there. The website remained live Saturday because its servers are in Amsterdam, and Walters said Wilson won't be forced to take it down. That would be a First Amendment violation, violation of his civil rights, and frankly the rights of everyone across the world who's looking at those pictures, he said. However, and this is the story that I found in the Miami Herald today, but it's not, I mean, found it today in, you know, with a Google search. The piece that I read over the weekend talked about how when they busted into his house, they carried out all his computers, took it all away, carted it off. Chris Wilson, 27 years old, running this website. All of a sudden, in Florida, Jeb Bush decides to enforce the anti-pornography laws and put this guy in jail. Why? Because he's got pictures from Iraq that, you know, kind of remind people that war is hell. We were reminded of this last night when three of the Gold Star mothers got up and spoke. And it was such a touching moment. It was such a powerful, powerful moment. When Nadia McCaffrey, Karen Meredith, and Annette Pritchard stood up and spoke of the loss to them and to their families. In the case of Nadia and Karen, of their only child in each case. The son that they lost was their only child. And Annette losing her nephew, PFC William Ramirez. And they talked about how this has touched their lives, that they'll never, you know, I mean, just, you know, one of them said that she would never see the wedding of her son that she had thought about all her life. She would never be a grandmother. And the other one talked about how before her son went off to war, he said, before he went off to Iraq, he said, if anything happens to me, please take care of my children. He had a 4-year-old, a 10-year-old, and his wife. And she's doing that. But what a horror to be visited upon a family. And we in America, I mean, it's easy to think about the thousands. Now, we're approaching this grisly milestone of 2,000. And in America, it's easy for us to think what a terrible thing it must be to lose a member of your family in the military. There's over 100,000, according to the best estimates of the British medical journal, The Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi families who have lost members of their family similarly. And the number actually may be much higher than that now that we've engaged in all these incredibly intense offensive operations in Fallujah and these other cities around Iraq. Now, Operation Iron Fist and Operation Iron Hand and Operation Iron Heart and all, you know, whatever they all are. And you can't, I'm sorry, you can't bomb people into liking you. One of the stories that Jim McDermott, the congressman from Washington State, told last night was how when he first went over, this was, you know, during the first Iraq war, how when he was talking to some Iraqis and they talked about how they get together and they work things out. How they all get together and they work out the details. And how two villages had done this. And they basically said, hey, don't invade. We don't need you to invade our country. This was when they invaded Kuwait. He said, don't go after Saddam. We'll take care of this. Just let us Arabs take care of this. And George Bush Sr. said, no, we're going to have a war. George Bush Jr., no, we're going to have a war. We are not helping ourselves. We are harming ourselves and the rest of the world. We are harming the cause of peace around the world. And it's a tragedy. I'm Tom Hartman. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Friends, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast. Ed Nixon is with us. Ed Nixon is the CEO of Pyron Inc., PYRONSolar.com. And, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Ed, are you related to Richard Nixon?
Yes, I'm the last of that clan.
You're his youngest brother, are you not, of our
right.
former president?
Right.
Uh-huh. And you're now in the solar energy business.
Well, that's one of the things. As I describe myself to people, my head is full of rocks because I was trained as a geologist.
And, okay.
But I still have some ideas that I think, even at my age, will be seen before I'm gone. And one of them is this gradual conversion, painfully gradual conversion to more reliance on solar energy.
Well, it was really 1973. Your brother was president of the United States when America first came face to face with the fact that we were, you know, that was more or less when we hit the Hubbard Peak here in the United States, and that we were at the mercy of foreign oil suppliers, and that there was the possibility of a real energy crisis that could bring this country to its knees.
That's right, and that's he's the one that first called for Project Independence, which we've repeated several times and still don't seem to wake up to the fact that we need to do this.
Who's the we who have repeated that?
American people. We're fat, dumb, and happy. Fat on fiat money, dumb to future certainties, and happily entertained.
Yeah, the bread and circus. Bread and circus. So, Ed Nixon, what are you proposing to do about this?
Well, I'm proposing to continue my own support of projects I see that are promising. And Pyron is not the only one. We've had a conference coming up here next week in Wenatchee, Washington, that will call in experts from several different technologies to address, you know, a marriage of hydro, wind, and solar to a point where we can really start developing some ways to generate and produce hydrogen without burning carbon. That's my mission.
You know, you almost sound like your brother. Forgive me.
Yeah, his secretary got us confused once in a while. I said, wait a minute, Rose, this is Ed.
Yeah, hey, don't delete my tape. Sorry about that. I couldn't, you know, too easy, too hard not to press.
That's all right. I showed him how to tape record, so
oh, jeez.
Anyway, that
what
was...
What a legacy.
That was a time of stupid questions from people looking for bad news, and we seem to be able to do that quite well, because... Yeah. As the New York Times used to be called, all the news is fit to print. It should be. All the news is bad enough to sell.
Well, there is the old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. And I think that what you're doing right now is something that that doesn't bleed, but if we don't pay attention to it, we all will be bleeding, at least energy-wise. And
right.
And I salute you. I congratulate you for what you're doing. I think it's marvelous. Do you believe, Ed Nixon, that the United States is really... not just the United States. Do you believe that the technology of renewables, and in particular solar, because that's the area where you put a lot of effort over the last couple of decades, do you believe that solar power is sufficiently advanced in the United States or technologically around the world that we could fairly rapidly make the transition away from fossil fuels and towards solar?
We could, but the attention we keep looking for, in fact, the inventors that came up with the Pyron concept are from Germany. They're brilliant, ingenious kinds of people with about 300 patents of their own. But this system they've been working on for 22 years and trying to get, as most Europeans do, government grants to do this or that. And that doesn't work in this country very well. People have to see that there's a profit potential, that it will supplant oil, reliance on oil sufficiently to make it a worthwhile endeavor. So investment from the private sector is what we try to do, but it's very hard to do. Just think about the transistor. Nobody would do it. We gave it to the Japanese and then started buying all our solid-state stuff from the Japanese.
Yeah, I was a ham radio operator as a teenager back in that era when the tube-to-transistor transition was made, and I remember we were making the very first, the CK722s was one of the very first transistors made in the United States. And, you know, it was basically a novelty item. And then all of a sudden the Japanese started making transistor radios, and boom, the door got kicked open.
That's right. Wake up time.
Yeah.
Well, I hope we can get some of this information out more broadly. I've spoken about this to Rotary clubs and other things around the country, and it gets a lot of interest. But where is that fellow with $25 million to kick this thing off? You know, it's close right now. I think we've got somebody willing to take a look at it and put in that first bit. What we have to do to get this one off the ground, Tom, is to get enough capital into it to start a mass production capability for the critical part, the solar cell, which right now Pyron is pointing to the one produced by Boeing for use in space. Well, you can imagine the price of those isn't going to work it. Mm-hmm. But getting estimates from Boeing, if we had an order for about 100 million of those cells, would the price come down? You bet it would. It would be, in fact, it would be so low, we could compete with any kind of energy, nuclear included.
Now, Ed Nixon, you brought up the example of the Japanese and the transistor, and that transition, that rapid movement in Japanese industry toward solid-state technology didn't happen just because Mr. Sony decided to invest in it. There's METI over there, MITI, the Ministry of, I forget, technology is in the phrase.
The government, that's right. The government did do a great deal of...
Hugely. Why can't we do that here in the United States? Why is it that we are giving $8 billion, $8,000 million that the Republican Congress and House of Representatives, the President Bush, just said, let's give $8 billion in welfare, in cash payments, to the oil, gas, and nuclear industries, which are among the most profitable industries in America, and nuclear industry being wildly subsidized from its inception. Let's give billions of dollars to them and nothing to the projects like what you're working on, these solar projects. Why?
I think it's for the same reason that the Democratic Congress back in the 70s did the same thing. Ignored Project Independence. We don't need to do that. Oil is fine. We can use that. We're all fat, dumb, and happy.
Is it because everybody's in the pocket of the oil companies, both parties?
Everybody burns oil. Everybody relies on big cars. Everything, you know...
So we're all junkies, and nobody wants to take on the pusher.
It's a tough thing. You won't be reelected. Well, maybe we ought to eliminate reelections, then see what happens.
Hmm. Yeah. I think. Go ahead.
The politics of our country is certainly preferable to anything else I've seen anywhere in the world, and you've traveled a lot too. You know what we've got. It's the best. But why can't we get this past the reality stage into something that's producing? Something of benefit to everybody, not just the United States, but the whole world.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that since 1973, 1974 was the point in time when the United States hit its peak oil production, and I'm doing this now from memory, but my recollection is we were producing, well, I'm not even going to try and do it from memory, but we're producing about half now of what we were producing back then domestically in terms of oil production, and yet our consumption has gone up dramatically since then. That you would think that this falls into the category of the commons. It falls into the category of those things that collectively we should be funding, collectively we should be working on, and that Republicans, Democrats, whatever you want to call it, that people should, you know, that our elected representatives, if they're really working in our best interest, should be saying, you know, hey, there's just mind-boggling amounts of power that hit the earth every day from the sun. Let's support some solar technologies, even some far-fetched ones. Let's throw a whole bunch of them out there and see which ones emerge.
Don't you think that it's really it's a call for better education to wake up everybody, not just students, but education of adults, more programs. Who watches the Science Channel, for example? Who watches these programs that do have some substance to learn something that they don't know?
Well, you and I do
more about what the sun produces. That's a great big thermonuclear furnace in the sky, and we're not using it except to roast ourselves on roasting racks for the benefit of dermatologists.
Right. Yeah, so there's so much that can be done.
Tom, I really appreciate your interest. I think perhaps you put your finger on the word that causes a lot of resistance is collective. That word comes back from the 1830s and beyond, and we've
the commons mean.
but it does call for ganging up on the technology that we have and making it work for us instead of just sucking the tube that feeds us.
Yeah, and that straw, it's getting harder and harder to suck on that straw of oil. And
it is.
The addiction is getting worse and worse. We're talking Ed Nixon, the president and CEO of Pyron Inc., P-Y-R-O-N, solar.com, the website. Ed, I just want to thank you for the great work you're doing and carrying on. What I think most Americans don't realize is something that your brother was, President Richard Nixon, was concerned about, the America's dependence on oil. Congratulations.
Doing well. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for being with us, Ed. Much appreciated. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour. Stick around. We'll be back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I ain't looking to compete with you, beat or cheat or mistreat you, simplify you, pacify you.
And welcome back, my friends.
Crucify you.
All I want to do is be friends, right? 20 minutes past the hour. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, I am spooked. It's like having a conversation with Richard Nixon. It was Ed Nixon. I just congratulations, Ed, on the great work you're doing, and I hope that you can get the investor funding for it, because it's marvelous to see. It's marvelous to see anybody, much less Richard Nixon's youngest brother, out there pushing the cause of solar energy. But there were times in that conversation where I just thought for sure I was talking to Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon played a very large role in my teenage years, and a very large unpleasant role, frankly. I guess nobody is all one thing. You know, nobody is all one thing. Nobody is all evil or all good. Everybody has their demons. Everybody has their goodness. Most people look in the mirror at night and tell themselves they're a decent person no matter what. And I'm sure that there were some, Louis says, except for Bush. No, seriously. I am convinced that George W. Bush, really believes that he's doing the right thing. He's wrong, but he believes he's doing the right thing. Aristocracy for America must be a good thing. 1-866-440-TOM, 440-THOM, our telephone number. And is it Lilo in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
Yes, am I on the air?
You are. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
My question is not directly related to your interview with Ed Nixon, but it does concern the lack of information and the misinformation that exists.
Yes.
And the need for a free press. And I wanted to ask you your opinion. What is your take on the possibility and feasibility of a new network that actually does investigative reporting and bring some informative science program, also entertainment program, sort of the anti-Fox network?
Well, I think on the one hand, there is an enormous opportunity to do that and to make money doing that and do a good job with that.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting to see, the Al Jazeera is talking about stepping into that vacuum themselves and starting a U.S. network that is just providing news, because they see that there's a lack of actual news. And, most people go Al Jazeera and it sounds like Al Qaeda. They don't know that there's a chasm of difference. And that Al Jazeera is actually out of Qatar, a government that we support. And if you have any curiosity about that, go see the movie Control Room, which is just absolutely brilliant. I think now you have to rent it.
But the
thing, the thing that probably works most against the emergence of a for-profit news network where there is actual journalism, good old-fashioned journalism going on in a serious way, the thing that works against that is probably the presence of public broadcasting in the United States. And I say that with very, very mixed feelings, because I'm a big fan of public broadcasting, and I think that we need to have our own BBC, as it were, here in the United States.
Yes.
And yet, most of the demand for, people wanting to really know the news is being met by the McNeil, what used to be the McNeil-Lehrer Report, the NewsHour now with Jim McNeil on public broadcast, on public television, and yeah. Morning Edition, and All Things Considered on public radio. There is a fascinating debate going on now, even among progressives, about the role of public broadcasting, because back in the 60s, when Nixon brought this into being, news departments of for-profit companies like CBS, NBC, ABC, individual radio and television stations. I mean, in the late 60s and early 70s, I worked as a news reporter and a radio station, actually in a couple of different places, and a TV station, a couple of radio stations, but spent the better part of 7 years working in one radio station in Michigan, in Lansing, Michigan. And people were doing serious reporting back then, and the original mandate of public broadcasting was to serve unserved markets. And news was not an unserved market. Unserved markets were things like children's programming or second language programming or educational programming and things like that. And it has become sort of a BBC thing. And there's but the problem is, the Achilles heel of it is that after NPR did such a marvelous job of outing and publicizing the crimes of Archer's Daniel Midland, ADM, back, you know, 15 years ago, it seems it must have been. I'm not sure the exact year. Now you find these same big corporations are big sponsors of public broadcasting. Public broadcasting is no longer outing them. And now you have, you know, big Republicans at the head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So, yeah. In fact, I call it sometimes the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of schizophrenia on the left, and frankly on the right as well, among, you know, people, you know, the kind of William F. Buckley crowd, the people who really believe that there does need to be good news. Everybody acknowledges, you know, Fox News is mostly spin and CNN is mostly infotainment.
Yeah.
And most of the network news is infotainment. So where do people go for news? Even conservatives go to public broadcasting, and yet it's increasingly falling under corporate sway. And at the political level, at the national level, it's increasingly falling under Republican sway. And so what do we do about that? I don't have an easy answer for that. All I can do is raise the issue. But I think you raised an important one, Lilo, and I thank you very much for the call and for, you know, bringing this issue out. It's one that we need to have a national dialogue about. Not a screaming, you know, shouting match, not a, hey, there's no sacred cows, not a, how dare you talk about that. But I think that we need to have a national dialogue about the role of news and whether we're going to go back to the way it was in the 80s, where news was public service. 27 past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small.
Oh, I think we've heard this one before. Hey, welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Beinhart wrote a piece in Editor and Publisher about the issue that was just brought up by our last caller. The novelist who wrote Wag the Dog and a Librarian is out with a new book called Fog Facts, Searching for Truth in the Land of Spin. And he wrote this op-ed piece that was published in Editor and Publisher, which is sort of the trade publication for people in the journalism business. He talks about how on October 2nd, in Lake George, New York, this was last weekend, the weekend before last, there was a terrible accident. 47 elderly tourists on a boat capsized, 20 drowned. Coverage excellent. He said, we learned all about the boat. We learned about the applicable laws, the customary procedures. We even learned that the boat had bench seats instead of bucket seats. The boat had passed its last inspection. Reporters were following up on similar accidents all around the country. He said, what was fascinating was how appropriate and thorough the stories were. More than that, how easy and natural it seemed that the story was reported that way. And then comes the kicker. And I'm telling you, this is the result, by the way. Let me just, before I tell you this story, let me tell you what's causing this. What's causing this is people like Cliff May and his bunch and all these guys who are these right-wingers who beat the media up every time they say anything bad about a Republican. And they just trash them, they savage them to the point that the media are knee-jerk terrified, people in the press, knee-jerk terrified to speak the truth about Republicans. Now, they'll talk about Bill Clinton, any little thing. They won't even do a poll right now to find out if the majority of Americans believe that George Bush should be impeached. They were doing polls like that on Bill Clinton every week. They will not do a poll. David Swanson over at afterdowningstreet.org is raising money to pay for a poll because none of the polling organizations, nobody will fund one. He needs 10 grand. He's up to about $6,500-$7,000 to fund a national poll on should Bush be impeached. A real national poll. But anyhow, so here's the story in Lake George, New York, a 47 LOD tourist, the boat capsizes. And then he says, contrast that. This is Larry Beinhart. He says, contrast that with what happened about a week earlier when it came out that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist was being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Justice Department for insider trading. If the story was covered at all, ABC World News Tonight passed on it. It was given bare bones treatment. AP reporters Jonathan Katz and Larry Marks were an exception. They followed up and revealed that Frist had lied about having no communications with the trustee about what was in the trust. But beyond that, in the early reports, we entered into the land of what Larry Beinhart calls fog facts. This is fog facts are things that have been reported somewhere sometime but have disappeared into the mist, like the pre-9/11 hints that there were hijackers in our midst. He points out Bill Frist is a very rich man. When he ran for the Senate in 1994, he said he was worth $20 million, and $13 million of that was HCA stock. That's the stock that he is now being investigated for insider trading on. His father started the company. His father's a multi-billionaire because of this company. His brother, Thomas, runs the company. None of this is being raised in the media. We know all the details about the boat that capsized. We know none of the details about Bill Frist. Which is more likely to have consequences for democracy in the United States? I think Larry Beinhart is on to something, you know, really big here. And this is the problem with the media. Even public television, even public broadcasting. It is the problem with the media in the United States. And it's one of the reasons, frankly, I think, that the Democratic Party has such a hard time getting traction is because nobody's willing to take the Republican Party down because these people have such powerful friends and allies, such large and powerful corporations that own the news media in the United States. Anyhow, let's get your thoughts on some of these things and pretty much anything else. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Susan in Lakewood, Washington on the line. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I enjoy your program, Tom. It's a treat for me to get to listen because I usually work during the day.
Well,
my comments surround your interview with Ed Nixon.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, wonders never cease.
Yeah.
Wasn't
it amazing to hear Richard Nixon's voice?
God, I guess.
Concerning
energy, and
yes.
It brought up stories that I have heard from my parents and grandparents. I'm 53 years old, so I wasn't around during the Second World War. I am told by, again, my family, that tires, automobile tires, were rationed during the war.
That's true.
Right. Why were they rationed?
They were rationed.
Yeah, because you couldn't get them. Why couldn't you get them? Because they were made out of rubber. And all the rubber trees were in Japanese hands.
Well, not all of them, but many of them. And they needed to recycle that rubber. And the other thing was that there were enormous quantities of rubber needed to be used for tires, for vehicles, for trucks.
Rubber was the bottom line.
Right, yeah.
And concerning oil, it's kind of deja vu all over again. We have allowed ourselves to become dependent on Mideast oil back in the days when, they gave it to us carte blanche for a pittance. Didn't take those people very long to get smart to realize that we had to have that oil. So
well, it's still a pittance,
like,
you know. In 1997,
like drug pushers, you know, they let us get addicted, and then they cut the supply, they raise the price, and it gets to be a round robin.
Yeah.
I would love to see us, with government help, become a hybrid society.
Yeah, I agree with you, Susan. I absolutely agree with you, and it's something that we need to do. We need to be looking at these issues in a serious way, and we're not. And we're just, you know, we're just pretending, oh, yeah, we can worry about that. And when Osama bin Laden, back in the mid-90s, when he essentially declared war on the United States, as Newt Gingrich points out, bin Laden had two goals. Number one, he wanted American troops out of Saudi Arabia. George Bush quietly pulled them out of Saudi Arabia last year. So we're no longer defiling Saudi's holy soil with women who drive and show their elbows and men who drink alcohol and shave. Number one, he wanted U.S. out of Saudi Arabia. Number two, he felt that oil should be selling for $200 a barrel. That we were stealing the wealth of his homeland. Now, think about it for a minute. How much, you know, at $100 a barrel, there's, you know, plus or minus 50 gallons in a barrel of oil. I think it's 54. I may be wrong on that. It may be 45 or 43, but it's in the neighborhood of 50 gallons in a barrel of oil. At $50 a barrel, that's a dollar a gallon. That's less expensive than coffee. I mean, there is virtually no liquid that we can buy as cheaply as we can buy oil right now, even at $80 a barrel. Coca-Cola is more expensive than oil. Bottled water is more expensive than oil. Coffee is more expensive than oil. You know, water, other than the water that comes out of your tap, any kind of liquid that you buy in a container, any kind of liquid, the soda pop that you buy, the orange juice, grapefruit juice, I mean, you name it, the cheapest liquid sold on the planet in a container right now is oil. And its byproducts, you know, and its derivatives, gasoline and whatnot. It's cheap. And so, you know, I think as time goes on, first of all, it's going to become more expensive. But secondly, we do need to be paying attention to alternative sources of energy. We've become absolute junkies on this stuff. Fritz in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm sorry, is it? It says Santa Fe, Nevada, but I'm expecting
that's
New Mexico.
That's right.
Is it? It's in New Mexico, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Hey,
hi, Tom. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you for calling. What's up?
I wanted you to know that there is a researcher out there somewhere in the void, I can't mention his name, who's working on mimicking green plants in terms of hydrogen production from sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look in any biology book, you'll find out that green plants do it with sunlight. They split water and they produce hydrogen.
Actually, they don't so much produce hydrogen. They combine hydrogen with carbon and oxygen and form carbohydrates.
No, they split water, Tom, to produce hydrogen ions, and the electrons are stripped off and run down the electron transport chain.
And what you end up with is not free hydrogen. What you end up with are carbohydrates, which contain hydrogen.
Right, but
I mean, we're saying the same thing, but it's not. But plants are not a hydrogen source. They're a carbohydrate source.
No, I understand that, Tom. I'm a biologist.
Okay.
But there is a way, in fact, he believes, to bind that hydrogen to a metal.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you bind hydrogen is bound to a variety of metals in nature. And my point is that this man is not getting funded. I could send you his name if you wanted. He's written a book on hydrogen production and binding to metals. And he's about the closest person I know, you know, who's close to being able to trap that hydrogen without obviously producing greenhouse gases.
Yeah, well, this is the perfect. I mean, I'm not a venture capitalist or whatever, but this is the perfect time for him to be out there knocking on doors and talking to folks. You know, Amory Lovin's group in Colorado and folks like that.
Yeah, he should hook up with Ed Nixon, I think.
Yeah, I mean, sure. It's, you know, not a bad idea. So yeah, if somebody can come along and figure out a way to essentially mimic photosynthesis, and that's, you know, at the when you get right down to the bottom of it, that's really what we're talking about with solar power and solar collectors, is mimicking photosynthesis, taking the energy from the sun and using it to extract something from it. Now, hydrogen, in my opinion, maybe I'm wrong, but hydrogen is not an energy source. Hydrogen is a way that you can store energy. You know, hydrogen is, you know, all around us right now. Water is, you know, H2O, two atoms of hydrogen, one atom of oxygen, and you've got water. So there, you know, there's just a profound amount of hydrogen. And you split the hydrogen separate from the water, and now you've got, you know, slightly electrically charged hydrogen. It will quickly combine back with that oxygen. The process is called burning, and that burning produces heat, and that heat is instant, you know, energy. So, as they discovered when the Hindenburg caught on fire. So, you know, that's, but anyhow, the point is that, you know, hydrogen, great. If you can figure out a way to split hydrogen out, then you've got a way to store sunlight. And of course, we have to think of oil as stored energy. You know, oil was plants 400 million years ago. It's stored sunlight. That's why I wrote the book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. You've got to figure out some way to get it out again. 45 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop in and say hi. George W.'s got a new charity. This is incredible, isn't it? A desperate plea by Bush and Company. They actually sent out a fundraiser. Won't you give? Water pumps are needed, as are school supplies and so much more. We know that you'll want to come through, for the American people are phenomenally generous, so please open your pocketbooks now. This is a charity drive for the reconstruction of Iraq. Iraq! The Bushies are asking for donations for Iraq. We've given 2,000 American troops, more or less, at over $200 billion from our public treasury. And the Bushies now, they want us to become charitable. Amazing. 866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Chris in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
How's it going, Tom? Maybe Bush can ask, you know, Exxon and Chevron and Texaco for some donations for Iraq since they're making all the profits. Yeah. By the way, I really do think that what we're seeing with the Harriet Myers nomination, how it's going down in flames, is that the Republican rats are finally jumping off the sinking Bush ship. I mean, they know that this woman is qualified.
I don't think so. I don't think so, Chris. I don't think they care if she's qualified or not. As long as she's going to vote their way. This is not about Republican rats escaping a ship. This is about conservative ideologues, Reich wingers. People who absolutely want to see a theocracy established in the United States and who don't believe that you should have the right to have an attorney if you're charged with a crime and have a trial by a jury of your peers. Those people are concerned that she might have an independent mind.
Right, I understand that. Well, the way I look at it is I don't see Bush as particularly concerned with an ideology or the Constitution. He's concerned with appointees that are personally loyal to him, not
sure,
to our Constitution.
Because he may be indicted.
Exactly. I mean, if you have half the White House staff indicted, he's going to need his White House lawyer on the court to protect them.
Well, if he gets indicted, he's going to need his White House lawyer on the court to protect him. that's what I've been saying all along. I see this as part, you know, it's a safe thing. Part, you know, she's somebody that he knows and trusts. And for in Bush's world, you know, just as in most mob families, it's not about competence. It's about loyalty. Loyalty
right.
is the deal, because when you're doing things that skirt the law, you have to be, you know, your first priority has to be to make sure that the people who have power over you are loyal. And that's what Bush is all about, is loyalty, not competence. And there are people who are concerned not about competence, because I don't think anybody questions whether Harriet Myers is a smart woman or you know, had graduated from law school and understands the law, or could even be a fairly decent Supreme Court judge. The concern is, will she be an ideologue? They want another Scalia, another Thomas. You get Scalia and Thomas out there saying, if it isn't written in the Constitution, you don't have the right, and which is the opposite of the intent of the founders. But they call it originalism, this new doctrine, and it's wrong. But these ideologues, I mean, you know, Robert Bork wants to take us back before Brown versus Board of Education. Forget Roe v. Wade. He wants to go back before 1954. He wants to go back before the Civil War. He wants to go back before the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And you know, as Arlen Specter, the Republican, said, if you had Bork in the Supreme Court, we would be revisiting Dred Scott. And that's the kind of person. There's no doubt in my mind, Chris, that if an ideologue had been put in, if George Bush had nominated somebody like, for example, Priscilla Owen or Janice Rogers Brown, who is not just a corporatist, not just somebody who believes corporations should have power over us, but somebody who has a clear record of being hostile to civil rights, hostile to human rights, hostile to the idea of the American way, and all in favor of corporate power, and also hostile to a woman's right to choose whether or not to have an abortion, that you would have the whole right wing just, you know, saluting in lockstep and lining up behind George Bush. This has nothing to do with his waning or waxing power on the right. This has to do with his nominating somebody that his base is not sure of.
Right, I understand. I do agree with you, what you're saying about the whole mafia mentality of the Bush folks and how they're just trying to basically, you know, cover their rear end at this point with all the indictments about to come down. But
yeah,
you're right. Their philosophy basically is to repeal the 20th century and go back to a time of laissez-faire economics where, you know, corporate criminality went unchecked as it basically is at this point in our
country. You're absolutely right, Chris. And it's not a joke. I mean, it sounds like you're just making a, you know, kind of an offhand comment, but it's not a joke. That's really what it's all about. Preston in Denver, Colorado, you're live and on the air. Hey, Preston, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You had mentioned the DVD, The Control Room, about Al Jazeera.
Yes.
I was wondering if you were familiar with the network that's developed in Latin America, thanks to Hugo Chavez and Lula in Brazil. They put their money together and started up something called Telesur.
Yes, I am familiar with it. I don't speak Spanish, so I've never seen it or been able to make, you know, sense of it. They don't have an English language service, to the best of my knowledge, do they?
I don't think so. Not
yet. Yeah, I think it's entirely in Spanish. But I'm you know, in broad strokes, I'm familiar with it. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I was. I'm hoping, and I heard that they will have an English version in the future, and they're just trying to respond to the efforts by, you know, the Fox News division in Latin America to try to colonize their minds.
Yep, and they're dealing with an enormous amount of disinformation coming out of the Bush administration as well, and trying to deal with that as well. Preston, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you, Jacqueline. In Everett, Washington?
Actually, Clinton, Washington.
Okay, Clinton, Washington. Hey, Jacqueline.
Hi. Hey, Tom. I actually just wanted to comment on your book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, just very powerful book that I actually had as required reading social science class in junior college.
Oh, isn't that great?
It was
life-changing. At the University of Georgia, they require it for some of their ecology classes. It's still out there. That's great. Well, thank you, Jacqueline, for your fine comments, your kind comments. Sorry, we've run out of time here.
Oh, no.
Thanks a lot for calling. And you know, spread the good word. Thanks for your kind comments. Thanks for being with us today, these 3 hours. Thanks especially to the folks here at AM 1090, Seattle's Progressive Talk, for hosting me today. And the great folks at AmericaSolidarity.com for the conference we had last night. Louise and I are on the train back to Portland this afternoon, taking the Amtrak back down there. Beautiful ride. And we'll be back on the air from our studio in Portland, Oregon tomorrow. Thanks for being with us. See you again tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.